The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
Our guest this week is Henry Newman. Henry is director of Open Europe. He's previously worked as a special advisor for Michael Gove at the Ministry of Justice and Francis Maud in the Cabinet Office. And just listen to this. He studied Persian with Islamic Studies and History at Christ Church, Oxford. He then studied for a Master's in Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard as a Frank Knox Fellow. He's taught 19th century Iranian history at the University of York, Middle East politics at Lincoln College, Oxford, a course of political Islam at Harvard's Department of Government, and government and politics of the Middle East at SOAS.
So why am I running a think tank on Europe?
That would be my first question personally, yeah.
You're not messing around, are you? Blimey. I'm afraid we're not going to ask any questions about Iran, but I feel that there could be a whole separate
Iran,
podcast.
Good or bad. You have 20 seconds.
I mean, I love Iran. I'm not very keen on the regime.
Welcome along. I'm now really worried that we need to include more Middle East. But let's start instead by discussing the royal baby stroke wedding. This is obviously the news that Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, all who are now not called that anymore, are expecting a baby in the spring, though no details on what the spring means or whether it was conceived before or after the wedding. We're assuming after, right? And the royal wedding of Princess Beatrice or Eugenie. I'm not sure which one it was. Now, polling's quite clear on this when it came to Harry and Meghan's wedding. Two-thirds of people weren't interested. Henry, how excited were you by Princess Beatrice or Eugenie's wedding?
I wasn't hugely excited, I'm afraid. I mean, obviously delighted she's got married. How lovely for her. But it wasn't a huge deal. I'm much more interested in whether the child of Meghan and Harry will be able to be a prince or a princess. I think that's the most exciting question.
No, I think they won't.
Unless the Queen decides, apparently.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
the Queen can change the rules, but as the rules stand at the moment, they're not going to be a prince or princess.
Do you think this has to go to the cabinet?
If it's a boy, he might get a curtsy title, like the Earl of Dunbartonshire. Don't ask me why my brain decided to remember that, but if it's a girl, then fuck all.
Interesting question. Should that child receive money from the public funds? I think this is something that's come up time and again.
That child should get a sword.
Get a ceremonial sword, but nothing more. Only 9% of the public think that Beatrice or Eugenie should receive funding from the public purse. I don't think they do get funding, actually, though they don't do any royal engagements either. Where do you draw the line, do you think?
I don't care. I just really don't care.
Well,
I'm French.
Exactly. Yeah. At least they should be lucky you don't want to chop their heads off.
I think it's quite difficult for a lot of the sort of extended royal family trying to find a role. And so I do feel sorry for, I guess, the more extended family. And in some ways, Harry and Meghan are about to sort of enter that category as well and trying to find the right role. But I think overall, what they announced their pregnancy in Australia. Country's obviously flirting with republicanism over quite a long period, and that's broadly a good thing. I'm in favour of the monarchy. Very not French, and hope we keep it, and hope that the Dominions also keep it. So I think it's a good thing that they spend time abroad in Oz and other countries.
I do have one thing to say that's just reminded me of a really posh friend of mine who was seeing this girl for a while, and then they broke up because they realised they were both in line for the throne and thought that was weird. So yeah, posh people.
That's a first world problem extraordinaire.
I was going to say, in the past, that was positively a plus. Well, one of the questions that comes up a lot is, do the births of royal princes and princesses or royal weddings have an effect on the polls? I can categorically say they do not. People don't just don't care. Princess Charlotte, of course, was born 5 days before the 2015 general election. Made no difference at all. Prince George made no difference. Both royal weddings just doesn't have an effect. So if you're sitting at home thinking, what will Theresa May think of this? I don't think she'll care very much. Well, I might be wrong. There is, of course, the question of football and the impact that has. The common thing is that Harold Wilson won the 1966 election because England won the World Cup, which is interesting because the election was in March and England won in July. So I think what that actually shows is that Harold Wilson's victory led to England winning the World Cup.
Or that people just get confused about political history and remember football more clearly.
That's true. Although England were knocked out of the 1970 World Cup 4 days before the general election where Harold Wilson lost. So, you know, maybe. No. Okay. When it comes to royalty, one place where we can all see them is on a banknote.
Oh, no.
And the new £50 note has been announced. There was debate about whether they'd get rid of it completely, but they have the Bank of England have kept it. But the question is now who should appear on that banknote. Harry Cole has already suggested Margaret Thatcher should be the face on it. Other suggestions have come in, including Philip Schofield, but I don't think that was entirely serious, though we never know. When the £10 note came out, Winston Churchill, Alan Turing and William Shakespeare were the top three in the polls there. Jane Austen was eventually chosen. When the £20 note came out, there was a poll that had a more selected list, and David Attenborough was the runaway choice, ahead of J.K. Rowling, Jamie Oliver and Richard Branson.
I was literally going to say, you know, on the Harry Cole thing, that, you know, I could not think of a choice more controversial on the £50 note than Margaret Thatcher. Jamie Oliver, actually, I would like to withdraw.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't think of one until I mentioned Jamie Oliver, and now you're thinking maybe there with a walk or something. What do you reckon, Henry?
I'm quite relaxed about Margaret Thatcher being on a £50 note, but I think the
Peter Mandelson.
I imagine most people wouldn't be.
Well, I don't particularly see why. I think it's now she's a historical figure, but I think it's a bit strange to have people who are still living on currency notes, and that's why I probably have tried to avoid.
Are you saying I should kill Peter Mandelson first?
I would like to point out that the Queen is still living.
But she appears on the other side of them. That's a different status. I'm also not completely convinced about the idea of putting all this to a poll, viz. Sort of Team at Boatface and other triumphs of push polls.
Well, that's true. Open access polls like this do open have a long history of causing problems. I would just like to say that if it does go to an open poll, I will be campaigning hard for Jamie Oliver to get on the banknote. I think that would be
him and like a child crying in the background, really sad. I just come back from Tory conference, and obviously I was shattered. It was like third conference
just
of the season.
Back.
Was massively delayed.
I had
again.
Just got back a few days ago, whatever. And like literally popped by the off license before going home with my rucksack and everything, and all I wanted was like mango Rubicon because I thought that's what would heal me. And they only had the fucking 50% less sugar one. Yeah, no, Jamie Oliver.
Henry, do you have any idea what Marie's talking about?
Sort of, but again, I think this is the ultimate first world problem as well. I'm in favour of mango Rubicon.
It tastes awful now. It was good. Iron Brew as well. The posh San Pellegrino, like fizzy thing as well. Jamie Oliver's ruined everything.
But why are they taking sugar out of Pellegrino? Have they?
Go ask Jamie Oliver. Yeah. The fizzy ones. The fizzy fruit ones.
The lemon San Pellegrino had more sugar in it than any other soft drink.
And it was great. It tasted so good.
Speaking of things that seemed like a good idea at the time, John Bercow has been a subject of some debate. In her 155-page report into bullying and harassment, Dame Laura Cox said there was a tradition of deference and silence around bullying and harassment, and that the speaker's office actively sought to cover up abusive conduct and gave no protection to those reporting bullying or sexual harassment. John Bercow has emphatically denied the bullying allegations against him, and he previously said he would plan to stay to oversee the whole of the Brexit process. Henry, as a student and teacher of political history, what do you think of the role of the speaker, and is John Bercow's time up?
I've never taught British history, should I add as a caveat. I think lots of people are quite happy with John Bercow because he's made some quite interesting changes to the way that Parliament functions and strengthened the role of select committees and backbench MPs. And I think that's all for the good. On the other hand, I think he's also allowed a partisan political agenda on occasion to slip into what he does. And I think, for example, his open dislike of certain front benchers at some level calls into question his impartiality. I think it'll be time for a replacement reasonably soon. On the other hand, it's up to parliamentarians. I'm not sitting in the Commons and actually dealing with this on a daily basis.
From a Brexit point of view, do you think it is good? Is it a good or a bad thing to have him in the position while Brexit takes place?
I think the reason why quite a lot of MPs are quite keen to keep him there is because they think that in the event that there isn't a parliamentary agreement on a deal, then he will give Parliament more and more opportunities to essentially take control of the process. And a lot of those things sit within the control of the Speaker. So they think that having him there, this is sort of people who ultimately might want to frustrate the UK exit or allow Parliament to take control in the event of no deal, they see having Burko there as a useful thing.
No, what I do find incredible is that, you know, like this report is horrifying, but also I think didn't come as a massive shock or surprise to anyone who is around Westminster, because like clearly bullying and sexual harassment is endemic in Westminster. You know, I've done some work on that. I've met so many sort of like young men and women who have been bullied and sexually harassed by their bosses and who've tried everything and, you know, tried to get help from many different places around the palace, and basically everyone was like, well, no, go to that other person, that other person, that other person. And most of the time these people just had to leave politics because they just couldn't handle it. And the fact that this has not become a major like scandal that's just been, you know, plastered across the news with everyone talking about it, I find absolutely incredible and really disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the there are very problematic elements of the working environment in Westminster, and this is another major investigation that clarifies a lot of that. I think it has been spoken about on, and key journalists, as well as yourself, have done a lot on this and trying to bring it to light. On the other hand, I do think that there's a particularly difficult problem in Westminster by the nature of the fact that you're working for elected officials and you do essentially work for somebody who, you know, you're in a very small team working for an MP. I don't think there are any easy answers here, otherwise they would have been grabbed at. And that is part of the problem. So just to sort of add that.
We're joined now by Sarbjit from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hello.
You were absolutely right about the excitement of the Bavarian elections last week. Were there some big winners or losers on that from your side?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of went pretty early on towards Green. So we were predicting the Green coming second place for a couple of weeks before the election. So we clearly had people on the inside who understood what was going on in Germany betting on our markets. So it's nice to see the mainstream media kind of catch up with that result and start talking down the AFD, who were otherwise predicted to come number two.
Yeah, great stuff. Today we're discussing Brexit and, of course, Theresa May's role in the negotiations. Your markets have 2019 as the most likely option for her to leave. Punters don't seem to be going for 2018 at all, despite the uncertainty of everything. Do you think 2019 is the smart thing to aim for?
I mean, I think we all have personal views on this, and I think that we've all been expecting her to go this year. The general public don't agree with us, and I think that this is a real question of like pundits versus the people. I'm going, my money's all on 2018, but other people think she can hang on to 2019. Maybe until the last moment she'll be there. We'll have to wait and see.
Marie, what do you think?
I would actually say 2020, partly to be contrarian, but also I genuinely think she will hang on for longer than people think.
And to be contrarian, I think she will establish a dictatorship and never leave. I don't know what odds I would get on that, but I imagine they wouldn't be particularly good.
You get 8.7%. Yeah, it'd be pretty good, actually. And 2020 as well, 12.82%. So I'd put money on it straight away at Smarkets if you could.
sounds good. Now, polls out today show that Boris Johnson is losing ground among both Leavers and Conservatives. He has negative ratings among those groups. Is he still the favourite to replace her?
No, actually, we've seen recent movement for Sajid Javid into that spot, 14.29%. Boris Johnson has now gone down to 12.2%. So he's been eclipsed by Sajid Javid, which is actually quite a reasonable choice, in my opinion.
All right, but of course, we know that the favourite never wins the Conservative contest. So do you think Sajid, if he wants to be leader, would be actively betting against himself?
Well, he's a clever guy, so I wouldn't put it against him. But, you know, we haven't noticed him at Smarkets, but we'd welcome him along with all the other candidates.
And speaking of movements left, right and centre, who are the most likely casualties from the next ministerial round that you guys have?
So number one spot for next cabinet minister to resign is Michael Gove, 15.62%.
Ah, interesting.
Followed by Penny Mordaunt. And then Dominic Raab.
Right, so it's Gove who's favourite. Maybe our guest.
That's really
will have
interesting, actually, because I feel like Gove was one of, you know, like one of the Brexiteers who actually privately, at least, you know, was kind of trying to convince people to back Chequers, or at least, you know, to kind of like stay in and work with it. Like, he was definitely not one of the hardliners over the summer. So it's quite interesting that that's changed.
Yeah, he has a very interesting profile. He's built a reputation in the Conservative Party for what he did at education. And now he's kind of looking to be the moderate and be the person who can heal the rift. But resigning could be the step towards, you know, obviously becoming prime minister. So at one point or another, the people who want to become prime minister have to resign and then, you know, stake their claim from outside.
And of course, we have the US midterms coming up as well. We'll be doing a special from the United States for that, which we're all very excited about. What are the early battlegrounds that are emerging from your stuff?
Yeah, I think it's individual races around the Senate are most interesting at the moment. We've got the Florida state election. And you've got Bill Nelson, who's a Democrat in Florida, versus Rick Scott, Republican. Bill Nelson's got about 56% versus Rick Scott at 49%. So it's a really close race there. And the question is, like, Florida's generally quite a Republican area, but Bill Nelson's a moderate Republican. So I think that's the one that people are going to look at as a kind of key battleground state. Also, obviously, Texas.
Yeah, I mean, the Beto O'Rourke versus Ted Cruz battle is one that's really attracted attention, not least for Marie.
It's attracted my attention.
How so, Marie?
Oh, no, I just find Beto O'Rourke quite attractive.
He is an attractive guy.
I don't really follow US politics. I'm open about it.
Well, it's a really interesting thing because obviously Ted Cruz has got a lot of media profile. His wife was verbally attacked by the current president of the US, which is pretty harsh.
Yeah, and of course he was a serial killer during the 1970s as well, which obviously impacts on his profile.
Come on, that's one of my two jokes, can you know?
I don't think that's true. But Beto's got that kind of profile. He looks Kennedy-esque. He's young, he's youthful, he's raised a lot of money. But, you know, this is Texas we're talking
about.
Didn't
kill loads of people in the 70s.
I like Texas a lot. They're very independently minded. It's, you know, nice place to visit. But it's a red state. So whether he can push this ball uphill and get a victory, who knows?
Very interesting. What price do you have him on at the moment?
So we have him at 26% versus Ted Cruz at 76%. So we're still predicting that Ted Cruz is going to take it, although his price has weakened over the last couple of months.
Interesting, interesting. Well, Subjit, thank you very much. We will speak to you again next week.
Great. Thank you very much.
Obviously, this week is heavily dominated once again by Brexit. Henry, you're the director of Open Europe. Tell us about your think tank.
So we are a think tank working on Britain's relationship with Europe. We've been around for quite a while, and we're doing obviously quite a lot of Brexit at the moment. And we didn't take an institutional position during the referendum, but we've been trying to sort of work out the best way forward since then. And I think we're now obviously in the end stage of the negotiations, and there's a lot of discussions about Canada Plus or Super Canada or Canada Plus 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 or Norway for now, Norway then Canada.
Canada!
And Chequers. And frankly, all of that is pretty irrelevant because the only question that is determining whether or not we leave the EU with a deal is whether we can get a backstop over the line. Everything else is agreed and nothing else matters for the withdrawal agreement. So we're having this completely bizarre argument where Labour is trying to apply six tests to a future arrangement that won't even be discussed. The EU have not even sat down as a 27 and had a scope discussion about what they want the future relationship to look like. So it's just bizarre to me that we're having this huge, very angry row with lots of emotions about the future relationship, which I think is important, but the EU is only saying you've got to agree the backstop or you can't have a deal. And I think at the moment, I'm yet to find a single parliamentarian who can sign up to the backstop as it currently stands.
Well, by the time this podcast goes out, everything might have been sorted out, and we might have found an easy solution to it all that was just escaping everyone for a moment. But assuming that's not the case, it's clear that we have a crunch couple of weeks coming up. The polling on this has been published frequently. There was a study out last week of 150 polls for the Evening Standard that showed a majority now want to remain, backing up a narrative that has been pretty consistent throughout the polling of this small movement, but it is a small movement towards that. There's an average now of a 4-point move to Remain, but that's still pretty small.
But then again, you know, Remain was leading in the polls in the months coming up to the referendum for ages, which is why, you know, that was such a surprise. So I find it quite interesting that some people are just like, okay, well, clearly this shows that, you know, if there was to be another vote tomorrow, actually, you know, would vote to Remain again, when you know, again, Remain was up in the polls for quite a lot of that time before the original referendum.
What I'm confused by, I think the idea of a second referendum is very far-fetched. If I think, if anything, it would be more likely to be a general election. But even if you get to a second referendum, the only circumstances where that could happen is a breakdown in the negotiations where she's unable to bring back a proper deal. And what we saw at Salzburg was that, fairly or unfairly, the Prime Minister wrapped herself in the British flag, stood in Parliament and blamed the Europeans and said, I'm not being given the respect that I deserve. And whether that or not that analysis was right or that argument was right, all the papers supported her pretty much. And she turned what should have been a humiliation into a triumph. And I think got a poll bounce out of that going into conference.
Yeah, certainly the polls after that showed that if you were a Remainer, you generally speaking blamed Theresa May. If you were a Leaver, you generally blamed Europe.
Whereas I blame everyone.
and she does seem to have received a bit of a bounce of that. Around about one in five people say the government is doing well in the negotiations. 19%, so that's not great figures. But it is higher than the lower 13% from back in July. So the situation has improved a bit, but it's obviously below the 40%.
Sure, I think a lot of people obviously think that If you talk in focus groups and whatever else, you hear arguments like, why haven't we just left? This is all just so ridiculous. The government's taking so long. But equally, that doesn't necessarily mean that people want to either change Prime Minister or change tack. You can be frustrated about the process, think the government's not doing a great job, but that doesn't necessarily mean you think, oh, if it came to a second referendum, I'd suddenly want to stay in.
From Open Europe's point of view, is the government doing well? Is there something that they should be doing that they're not?
Well, I think I could write a long list of mistakes that the government has made in the negotiation, but I'll try and avoid shoulda, woulda, coulda, and focus on where we are now. And I think that ultimately now, as I said, the only thing that matters is the backstop. And the backstop would in perpetuity divide Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK in customs and regulatory terms. And that's just unacceptable. So I don't see what she does other than hang tough at this point. And as I said, I've spoken to MPs from across the conservative political spectrum, from the kind of hardline to the Europhile, and none of them are happy with the backstop that divides the UK. When this question
so
of
how
a customs...
about a full UK backstop?
But that a full UK backstop, what would that mean? A full UK customs union? Because that doesn't solve regulation, because you then have a regulatory border in the Irish Sea. If you look at the total checks done at the border, most of those are regulatory, not customs checks. Barnier has a slide where he shows what a customs union would solve, and it's about 3 out of about 30 things. And that's why Ruth Davidson over the weekend suggested that she would be unable to support the backstop as it currently stands, because it would divide Northern Ireland to a separate regulatory zone. So I just don't know what the way through is other than the Prime Minister hanging tough at this point and the EU agreeing to fudge this and kick the can down the road.
So hang on, so what would be needed? Would you need to have like regulatory convergence as well as a full UK backstop then in order for that to work?
Potentially, yeah. And then how would that, what would the framework for that be? Ultimately, that was the whole problem with the backstop, is that the EU wants us to resolve the backstop without being able to discuss the future. But the backstop obviously impinges on the nature of the future. And the irony of the current Brexit impasse is that we're unable to resolve an insurance policy to prevent the hardening of the Irish border. And because we can't get an insurance policy to stop the hardening of the Irish border, we might have no deal and therefore a harder Irish border. It's that silly.
All the saber-rattling that's coming out from the DUP, do you believe that they will actually go through with it and bring down the government, or do you think they will cave?
I think the DUP are very, very serious about maintaining the integrity of the UK. So I wouldn't want to play chicken with the DUP on that question. I think they would prefer a Corbyn government, or indeed almost anything other than dividing Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK.
I feel like I'm aware that that would make things worse as opposed to making things better. But on these arguments, I always feel like I don't get why no one goes up to Arlene Foster and goes, OK, fine, you know, let's keep the UK as it is. But also in that case, you know, allow abortions and gay marriage in Northern Ireland. That's that. Like, if that's going to be your entire argument of keeping the UK kind of, you know, united as one kind of entity, then in that case, why is no one... Again, I know that it would make things worse as opposed to better.
But I do think
that's what you're here for.
But that's not the same thing. I would rather there was same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland and abortion. But ultimately, there's been a long-standing devolution settlement that recognised that those rights are devolved, not reserved. And I don't think it's perfectly reasonable to point that out. But I think she would say that what we're being asked to do here is change the constitutional makeup of the UK. And it's not just putting Northern Ireland in a different zone in terms of regulation. What it would mean is that in perpetuity, the people of Northern Ireland would have rules made for them over which they had absolutely no ability to control or influence. And I don't see how that's even human rights compliant in terms of the Human Rights Convention. You can't have a situation where you cannot influence any of the rules which are controlling you.
Henry, you worked very closely with Michael Gove for a period of time. What do you think his game plan is on Brexit?
I mean, I don't speak for Michael, but I think from what I understand.
But if you were to speak for Michael, can you do an impression?
I can do an impression of Michael. Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
That's weirdly good, actually.
That was very good, yeah.
Very good. Right. You even did the hand as well, for those of you listening at home.
I think most pragmatic leavers, and I interviewed Dominic Raab at Conservative Party conference, and he was saying, you know, we have to accept the situation as it is, and we've got to quote Geoffrey Cox, you can't always get what you want. You can't get everything. The country was divided 52-48 and remains pretty divided. As you were saying, almost nobody's changed their mind. And on top of that, there's a hung parliament and there's an EU27 that are determined to, if not quite punish us, make sure that we don't get a better deal on the way out than we had on the way in. So, you know, I think you've got to be a bit of a realist. And there's a camp of leavers within the cabinet and within the party who basically recognise that this is going to take quite a while to get Brexit right overall, and you've got to make compromises.
And would you see Gove as the leader of that group of pragmatists?
I think there are lots of different people. But I think the person who's, in some senses, has the most control over the Brexit process now is Dominic Raab, right? He's the Brexit secretary, and he's made very clear that he's a pragmatist. Michael Gove's the environment secretary, but it's Dominic Raab who is actually in charge of a lot of the elements of the day-to-day process. Now, there was an argument when he was first appointed, look, all the decisions have been taken, it's kind of an irrelevant job. I never really bought that, because I think that Dominic Raab secured when he got that job that he would be consulted in a way that David Davis had previously been excluded from some decisions. But more importantly, the Prime Minister's lost one Brexit secretary. To lose another one would be really quite a thing. So I think Dominic's actually in a very strong position now to call shots on the next few steps of Brexit.
We spoke to Subject from Smarkets earlier about who they have as the next most likely minister to resign, and they have Gove as the top. Do you think that's likely?
I mean, I think at this point, if you follow the news in the Express, then at least half the cabinet are about to resign. So I think it's kind of
I don't think it's as little as half.
Right, okay. I mean, when you've got Ruth Davidson threatening to resign over the backstop as well, then I think it's kind of.
Oh yeah, I think it should be a curveball. I think Gavin Williamson. That's going to be the first one to resign.
You imagine him trying to emulate Geoffrey Howe's speech. Desperately shoehorning in cricket metaphors to attract attention.
I'll let Julian Smith just like, fuck this. Like, I am hating being chief whip. This is awful. Fuck you all.
What do you think the tweet of the phone on hold was?
I have no idea. Now, I wonder, because it was Sunday night, I wonder if that was not a kind of like, I'm just taking the evening off.
So explain this for both our listeners at home.
Also, Julian Smith, the chief whip, tweeted, oh yeah.
I'm beginning to think Henry hasn't listened to this and is not aware of the in-jokes we have. More fool him for the last section of the programme.
But you had to do this picture of like this phone sort of like...
Not on the hook, basically.
Well, yeah, not on the hook. And no one knows, like no caption, nothing. So I think it was just like... It was on a Sunday night, wasn't it?
It was in the middle of, I think, when everyone was sort of threatening resignations and crisis was swirling.
Yeah, so I feel like this is more a kind of, you know, like nearly that like bottle of wine out of shot being like, I'm going to watch Strictly or whatever it is. You know, Doctor Who, I'm going to watch Doctor Who. I am out.
And
chief
Raab had just gone to Brussels, right? And then come back having supposedly had a deal, then not had a deal, and everyone was sort of marched down the hill.
So yeah, I think that was just like, fuck you all, I'm taking the evening off. But who knows?
There are lots of different descriptions for the different types of Brexits that we've talked about. Canada, Canada Plus, blind Brexit, hard Brexit, soft Brexit, etc., etc. Do you know how to work out your preferred Brexit?
I'm going to regret saying that, but no, Joe, please tell me.
Because I've worked it out and I'm making it a thing.
Oh, no.
What you do is you work out the number one single from your 18th birthday, and you take the last word from that and add it to Brexit.
Is this like your porn star name?
It's a bit like your porn star name. And so Marie, for instance, your 18th birthday corresponded with Killing in the Name of being
really?
Number one. Or Killing in the Name, technically. So that's Name Brexit, you see. Theresa May, Kung Fu Fighting. So she wants a fighting Brexit.
I thought it was Red, White and Blue.
Jeremy Corbyn, Silence is Golden. So that becomes a golden Brexit. Nigel Farage, Seven Tears by the Goombay Dance Band, whoever they are. So he wants a Tears Brexit. Dominic Raab, it was Stay by Shakespeare's sister.
Stay Brexit.
You see, it all works together.
Was it 18th birthday or the day
18th
you were born?
18th birthday. Henry, director of Open Europe, you turned 18 when Life is a Roller Coaster by Ronan Keating was number one, which means roller coaster Brexit.
I mean, that's,
is your
to be
ideal.
Fair, pretty much where we are at.
Exactly. So this genuinely works. So go on, find out what was number one when you turned 18 and tweet us your Brexit.
I just want to make it clear this is a Joe Twyman idea, not a polling politics idea.
This will have them rolling in. Henry, what are you afraid of?
Sharks.
Sharks? Oh, that's interesting.
It's a lacophobia.
Because I'm afraid sharks does not make the most common phobias for Britain. Marie, what are you afraid of?
Am I allowed to tell a relevant short story first? Or
please do.
So I went to this
we
immersive...
We can always edit it out.
That is true. I went to this immersive art experience thing a few years ago. And so there was a woman guiding us. And at some point she gave us a piece of paper that just said, what's your biggest fear? And so I wrote this, because it was this quite intense place. So I wrote basically a paragraph of fear of failure, blah, 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 blah.
Half sugar, and then... manga Rubicon.
Should have written that, because I wrote something weirdly deep, sort of, fear of failure, I'm setting myself up for failure, blah, blah, blah. Oh. And then the woman that we all gave them back, the woman read them out, and everyone else had said, mice. And then I had just a paragraph of existential crisis. Thank you very much.
Fear of taking myself too seriously, perhaps, would have been.
Continental divide.
Well, mice is definitely.
Oh no, cockroaches! Cockroaches.
Cockroaches doesn't figure. Mice was number 6 on a poll. What do you think was number 1 for Brits?
Spiders.
French people.
French people, no, French people doesn't.
Yeah, I'd say spiders
figure.
As well.
Spiders, number 4.
Hey. Oh,
number 4.
What's the top 3?
Well, the top Rats. Three. Top three. Public speaking. Was number 3. 20% were very afraid of that, with a further 36% a little afraid. Snakes, 21% very afraid.
That's very Freudian.
And at number 1, 23% very afraid, 35% a little afraid of heights.
Oh, okay.
I'm
slightly afraid of heights as well, actually.
I thought I was fine with heights until my friend took me for a drink at the top of the Shard, and then I was like, nope, absolutely not.
You try climbing, and that's quite...
Well, obviously, if you try climbing...
I'm very afraid of heights, but I can climb, but I do get to the point
just,
where I'm sort
just
of...
Just not very high?
Shaking. No,
only to the height.
I can climb to the top of the wall, but I just find myself sort of...
But only if the wall is
completely exhausted
high.
By the end of it, because I've been shaking so much.
Oh, really? So do you think that your fear of heights actually boosts your enjoyment of climbing?
Not really, because it just makes the whole thing completely exhausting, but it's a kind of determination to do it, even though I'm scared of it. It's like...
Interesting metaphor for Brexit, actually. As someone who favours a roller coaster Brexit.
I don't favour roller coaster Brexit. That's your bizarre algorithm. What about death? Isn't that the thing everyone should be afraid of?
Death isn't on the isn't on the list, I'm afraid.
I feel like there's nothing you can do about it, though. I'm quite relaxed about it.
Darkness. I don't know if that counts.
Looking will you cross the road, sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Crowds, 21%. So over 1 in 5 people has some degree of crowd fear. Flying on a plane, 7%. Needles and getting shots.
Oh, needles, yeah. I really dislike them. Once when my dad was trying to give me a vaccine, he had to run after me around the garden.
But your
for ages.
Dad was trying to give you a vaccine.
Oh, he's a doctor. Sorry, I feel like I should have opened with that.
Why was he running around the garden with a needle or with just.
Well, basically, because I didn't want a vaccine, and so I was just running around, and he was as a result. I really hope the neighbours didn't see.
I was going to say, there's someone peering over the fence into the LeConte household.
It's just a very well adjusted family.
I imagine that's what happens exactly like that in all French households. That's it. Henry, thank you very much for coming in. We shall be back next week. No time for our interview with the guy that went swimming naked in a shark tank. And we'll leave you with a quick look at video footage of Marie running around the garden being chased by her dad with a needle. Cool, you did go for it, didn't you? Thank you to Subject Bakshi. This episode was sponsored by Smarkets. We will be back next week. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.